is, you know. Oh, I think!
This is Filthy Shambles. It's season 3. It's episode 40. It's a post-North London Derby podcast. I have no idea how many people are going to bother listening to this because of all the games to lose, this is the one game twice a year that you do not want to lose as a Tottenham supporter. And for the most part, you just want to not think about it and not have to listen to other people talk about it. But this is what we're going to do today because we're going to process the process. I've had my therapy session yesterday, recording the Fighting Cock. Today I'm joined by Dan, who I think is probably in the same position as I am, enjoying a beer and just wanting to talk about what happened because it was a paradoxical game. It didn't feel like a 3-0 when we were 3-0 down. And it's just, why did Tottenham do this? Why does Spurs do this to us? It, regardless of the manager, regardless of the context, we always seem just, I don't know, underprepared or just a little bit. I mean, it's unfair to say that considering the 2-2 back at the Emirates earlier in the season. But often I just feel that there's something missing. And any London derby opposition that we play, whether it's Arsenal, West Ham, Chelsea, they all know, they all get the memo, they all turn up and they do exactly what they need to do on the day to try and win the game, right? Mm. Whereas I think with us, it always feels like Tottenham defeat Tottenham. Do you know what I mean? It always feels like it's, and I know that's probably not the case, okay, in the grand scheme of things, it's not like Arsenal turned up and did nothing and won the game. They knew what they were doing. We can talk about the tactic clashes. But how do you feel now? It's been like a couple of days. Are you kind of over it emotionally? Are you detached from it? Are you looking ahead to another London derby? Or yeah, are you still like troubled by what you watched?
I think there's things that I still probably want to reconcile from the game and the performance, like most people. But
yeah,
I mean, overall, like, you know, it's not the first time we've lost at home to Arsenal, and it probably won't be the last. I hope it's the last for a while, because you always want your home form against them to be so strong. And I thought that because we did play so well at the Emirates back in September or whenever it was, and we scored a couple goals. I think we've scored more goals against them than any other team this season, and you just sort of felt really confident going to the game. I was really looking forward to it. I weren't scared. Like, I didn't think we'd get battered or anything like that. I know that, I think I kind of went with an open mind that literally any result can happen. Maybe they could turn us over, and maybe we could really turn them over, and maybe it could be really tight. And the scoreline kind of obviously ended up painting it as like a narrow Arsenal win in the end. It's so funny that when you're in the ground, I think you feel so differently than if you were to be someone watching it at home, not on the telly and stuff like that. I do feel okay now, like, for the most part, because as I say, like, we've got another game in a few days and you just got to be able to get on to the next one. And all we can, I suppose, at this point, I think it's more hope than belief that we'll be able to have kind of shaken that off and we'll be a lot better for the next game, considering that the next opponent isn't as good as them. So if we can, I mean, it's football isn't logical as a sport. Like, it isn't a case of, well, we lost to them narrowly and they're top of the league, so we should then smash the team that are sat in eighth. But it just doesn't work that way.
No. No, it doesn't, mate. And especially, we'll get onto the Chelsea game later, but especially in that type of derby where, again, the onus is on them to to just ruin our night. If you want to run with the narrative that they're a bit obsessive about beating Tottenham, but that's the pressure's
the pressure's not on them though, is it? Like, I know we're going to talk about them later, so I won't go over it too much now. But the pressure is on, isn't on them? It's on us, isn't it? Like, let's be real.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, let's try and do this. I mean, there's a lot of things that I'm probably going to repeat from. And I'll try not to, from the chat I had with Flav and Big John Bass on the Fighting Cock.
Yeah.
But I mean, this has been done to death, no doubt, anyway. So I don't want to do a blow-by-blow analysis of the game.
Yeah.
But we can talk about how... I don't know if you found this talking to your Spurs mates, but it was one of those performances, like, in the moment, I kind of just, being at the game, watching the game unfold the way that it did, I was just staggered at how easy it was for them to go 3-0 up, right? Because it felt like we have seen this. Well, there's no doubt that this is a trend, basically. This is a trend. We have seen it time and time again. We allow teams to get behind us really, really easily. Sometimes on the break, we're just very slow to react. Everyone's looking at each other. We know we're very poor, extremely poor at set pieces. That's an entire conversation on its own. But we went 3-0 down to three goals that weren't necessarily brilliant football. But, you know, the kind of preamble to this game that I experienced was, oh, God, Arsenal are on one. They're smashing teams left, right and centre. They're going to pull us apart. And at no point in the entire game did I think that they were that much better, superior to us in terms of their application and the movement of the ball. Now, people are going to say, and this is, I guess, this is where the noise comes into it. Some people are saying it's embarrassing because Arsenal didn't have to change gear. Therefore, they did not have to try. They just knew how to punish us, and they took those opportunities. They played the patient game. All things very, very true. But the other argument is that we didn't let them play. We had most of the possession, which we do in a lot of games. And you almost feel that if we're more tidy defensively and we are better creatively, then we're more likely to not lose these games and actually be far more competitive and not apply the pressure on us. So I want to talk about why the stats look good, you know, in one aspect, from one angle rather, but the eye test fails miserably. We can talk about that, but just your, what was your gut reaction to going 3-0 down? Like that moment, it was when it was three. Did you think, holy fuck, we're going to get pulled apart here? This could be humiliating, or I mean, where was your head space at in that moment?
Yeah, I was fuming. Like, I was really angry, and it's worse when you're in the ground, I think, at times as well, because you, like, I mean, it's not great being at home or in the ground, but I was just surrounded by people that were just lost for fucking words at what we were seeing, because it looked the third goal was, I said to people after the game, that was a training exercise goal.
Yeah.
Like, all of their players moved and ours was all static. Like, in that whole sequence.
It's schoolboy. It's schoolboy playground.
I just don't understand how you expect to defend anything when you're... it's impossible to stop them from scoring, because that ball's coming in and it weren't coming in with pace from Rice either. Like, it was just a floated ball in. But because they're all coming with momentum, you're not going to be able to stop them or get a jump on them, because they've just... The momentum's with them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, there's a few things there, whether it's like the goalkeeper or the defenders, like all of it was wrong. So it was just horrible to watch from that standpoint. But it was really frustrating because it didn't feel like they were playing the nicer football. Like, I didn't think that we were exactly brilliant at creating chances ourselves. We created chances and should have done better with them. There was the Son chance in particular, but I didn't feel like we were being outclassed. I thought that they were just ultimately, they were really good defensively. Like if you look at our two goals, one of them was down to a mistake and the other one was down to a penalty. At no point did we score like an open play goal that we'd kind of crafted ourselves, you know. Yeah. And to an extent, neither really did them, other than two pieces of, one own goal, a really poor piece of defending at a corner. And if we had our first choice left back, I don't know if we, if that goal even goes in. Like if the, if he faces him up in, maybe it does. And like, and I'm talking out my arse here, but it just seemed like we all knew what Saka was going to try and do, and was screaming to not let him go on his left as a fans on the stand. And it's exactly what he did, and he just made it look so simple. So it's just really frustrating to watch, mate. And then ultimately, I was kind of, straight after the game, I was really down. Really, I didn't really speak much. I was with my dad for the rest of the afternoon and just didn't really. I just felt like I was sort of just kind of nodding, and he was kind of venting at me, and I felt really bad because I just didn't have the energy to talk. I felt really gutted and down about the result, because it didn't matter how much effort and fight we showed in the second half, we gave it away in the first half. The game is gone. You give them three goals, like, they're good enough as it is. They're a really good side. Like, you give them a leg up, like, they've not played well when you've given them a leg up, and they're just gonna take that all day long.
So let's start on that and kind of work our way through the midfield and the attack and obviously how the game played out. I'm trying to remember earlier in the season how we were defending in terms of set pieces. And I don't think it was a discussion point. I don't think we were saying at the time that we were weak or untidy in terms of the way that we would position ourselves to defend set pieces. Now, maybe I've just forgotten, misremembering. I don't have any data in front of me. I'm not going to just start spitting out numbers, because in the grand scheme of things, again, it doesn't mean much. I mean, it does, you know, in terms of you can work with those numbers to then talk about why we are conceding X amount of chances and whatever else, and where the players are standing. Is it zonal marking? Is it man marking? Whatever else. But I don't, for me, dumbed down podcasting here. For me, I think it's the general fluidity of a football team, right? If you have a spine that is strong and you have a midfield that is fairly dominant, you know, there was a discussion around, you know, if you took two midfielders out of Man City, or even if you took two midfielders out of the Arsenal team and stuck them in the middle of our midfield, the game changes almost immediately, right? Because I feel that what we're missing as a football team is that spine at the moment. It doesn't seem to... It's like you need an area, defence, midfield and attack. They all have to be playing well, but you need them to own what they're trying to do. I'm not saying you're going to boss and win every single game of football, but you need to look at each department and know that they're going to deliver what they're selling. And in this case, I don't think the midfield do enough. Creatively up front, we keep hitting that congestion outside the box and slowing down the game and the pace of the ball. And then obviously the defence, man for man, are brilliant defenders. But as a unit, there's something that's not quite gelling. And if it's the fundamentals, and then you kind of look at Ange Postecoglou, and he's played it down that he doesn't have a set-piece coach. And then you've got people talking about his time at Rangers, they were conceding 33% in the first season from set-pieces.
It's time for Celtic, you mean? Celtic.
Sorry, Celtic. What did I say?
Rangers.
Rangers, fuck's sake. And there's only two teams in Scotland. How can I get that wrong? So, like, at Celtic, 33% conceded, and there's like talk around how they would always collapse, they'd dominate and boss games, and then they'd fall apart because there'd be this moment of pressure. They'd concede a silly goal, and it's all gone. Second season, it improved, but still 15% does sound like a lot to concede from set pieces. If you're banging in the goals at the other end of the pitch, then it probably doesn't matter as much because you're winning more games, and so there's less emphasis on you conceding. But it is a fundamental, right? And the fundamentals are important. But how important do you think this is to the criticism that he's receiving from? And I say criticism in the nicest way possible. Like, I'm criticizing him now. You know, I want to understand. Does he acknowledge there's an issue here? Can he see that there's a problem here? Do we need to change the way that we defend? Do we play three centre-backs at the back? Do we play four centre-backs at the back? I mean, I don't know what it is. I don't know what the answer is right now. So I'm not paid to really resolve that. I can talk about it for free. But what are What's he doing? What are the players doing? What are the coaches doing? What are you thinking about this kind of basic fundamental that's failing us right now?
Well, I think he was clearly really angry after the game. That was probably the most angry we'd seen him in a post-match presser, because I think he knew what was on the game. Like, it's a North London derby. You want to beat your main rivals. And I think he probably felt that the players had let themselves down to a certain extent. And he didn't seem... He sort of bit in the end at when sort of up being probed on details that weren't quite right. And he was talking about how we were appealing for a penalty when we should be playing to the whistle and focusing on the play going up the other end when Saka scores. And maybe we prevent that from happening if we weren't so preoccupied. And I think that's a fair observation. It winds me up when players do it. I know they probably feel like they need to appeal massively in order to get any sort of VAR decision these days, but like, the play's carrying on with or without you, and you can't then control the outcome after that. Like, it's out of your hands. Like, you're in the hands of a VAR at that point. Like, you just need to try and control what you can, I suppose. But with what's happening, like, I mean, we are obviously conceding. Like, I don't know the stats on the amount of goals we're conceding in terms of set pieces. We're clearly, but just from what we see, we do seem to talk about it a lot, which suggests that there is a problem there and that we've got a weakness that a lot of teams are starting to exploit now. I think Vicario does need to start either being, he does need protection, but he also needs to be stronger. He's 6'4" and dealing with players that are mostly smaller than him. Like, if they're barging up against him, he's allowed to push them out of the way. Like, and especially do it before the whistle, before the ball's in play. He can't then give away a penalty anyway. So
what
just
do
get
you
him
think
off
about that though? Do you think he's been? Look, there's a difference between being targeted and being fouled, right? You can target a player, but we know, we've seen it. Games that we go to, games on TV, the amount of running around and shirt grabbing and pulling and all the other bullshit that happens in the penalty box in the 6 yard. Box, and it's you know, the referee comes dancing in, blows his whistle, pulls people apart, they go at it again. You know, you see players kind of jump on keepers. Now, most of the time the keeper gets, you know, he gets the decision in his favour. It's like, you cannot touch a goalkeeper. But it
seems like... Yeah, but half the
like...
reason they get the foul is because they've jumped and tried to do something to claim for a ball, and then they've fallen down, haven't they? He's not even doing that. He's just standing on his line and letting the guy get away with murder. And obviously, he needs someone to protect him as well. Like, I don't know why the fuck it's not... It's no one's... Look, we see it all the time. I get their zonal marking, but it doesn't take a brain surgeon to figure out that if you put a body in there to literally just back into Ben White the way he's trying to back into Vicario... Time it as well. Like, you do it at the point that the ball's about to be kicked, so that you're not fouling him, but you're giving Vicario enough, like a split second of breathing room to go and claim that ball. Because I'm sure that he's big enough and confident to go and claim the ball if he felt he had the room to do it. But it's kind of between him and the players. They need to just be stronger in that moment and just have a bit of streetwise.
It's just aggression, right? It's just more aggression from the
defenders. And players aren't taking responsibility. Like, we can all say, oh, the coach needs to be doing this and that. Like, anyone who's played football knows that when you're on the pitch, like, you wise up to what's going on around you and you adjust to the situation. You fucking take matters into your own hands. You don't just shirk responsibility and say, well, my manager told me to stand here, so I can't go and protect him. That's a fucking nonsense. Like, look at Romero. He's all over the pitch. He's at centre forward because he wants to win the game, and he's taking matters into his own hands.
We're going to talk about him separately, because... if you want to talk about one positive from the game on Sunday, it's him. It is interesting, though, that I kind of had a flashback when under Conte and Mourinho, when you know, things like this would happen. It would be like, the players aren't listening to the manager. Obviously, the manager's telling them what to do and the players aren't following the instructions. But for Ange Postecoglou, from some critics... I don't think he gets that wiggle room, basically. It seems to be all on the manager, mainly because people, again, are embracing this entire narrative around, we will not change and we will play as we play. And people just think it's just as basic as it comes. I think it's become, again, this meme is just being pulled left, right and centre. It was the journos and the pundits playing around with it, and now... Some Tottenham fans, and again, this isn't a social media thing, before anyone thinks I'm getting on my high horse again, because I, you know, being at the game, you get to talk to people at the game, and get to listen to their opinions. And everybody that I spoke to and everybody that I overheard are definitely backing Postecoglou, but they're asking these questions, and they're valid questions to be asked. And obviously, if you're a bit weird and you foam at the mouth, you're probably more likely to go, I want him out now because he ain't going to change, because that's how I feel. And that's great. That's how you want to live your life as a Spurs fan. Crack on, because when the next manager comes in and he's not doing something right and there's a bit of a weakness with a fundamental, what do we do? Do we sack him as well? Do we give everybody 10 months, basically? And if, you know, to quote the Fighting Cock and John Bass, if we're not winning the league, then sack him and bring in someone else. Anyway, I'm ranting. And I don't want to rant. I want to talk. I want to try and be pragmatic and play devil's advocate and try and sit on the fence and be both critical of Postecoglou and then obviously align with my more stoic opinions about how, you know, progress is something you need to work through, and you have to work hard at it, and you shouldn't feel entitled. No one should feel entitled. And maybe some of the players are feeling entitled. Maybe they thought they'd done enough to get results, and it's kind of fallen apart a little bit, and now Ange's having to manage the team and players individually, not giving everything that they need to be giving out on the pitch. So anyway, we know the free kicks are a problem, the set pieces are a problem. We're Thursday we're playing Chelsea. We're going to get to see if we have learned anything in the short term. We didn't seem to learn much in the 15 days leading up to the game, but that doesn't help either. We've now got Chelsea, we've got Liverpool, and we're talking about those fixtures because it's a manic end of season for us. Not that it's probably going to change much for what Spurs do, but it might change a lot for what other teams achieve in the league. So you got the defence, you got 3-0 down. Obviously, we come out second half, and you know it's that thing again with Spurs. Like the level is. I got criticised in a WhatsApp group for saying that we didn't show enough spirit in the first half. Like there was something lacking. And I'm thinking maybe spirit was the wrong word to use. Maybe it's electricity. This isn't something that people that follow stats will be able to mark down on a piece of paper or Excel sheet. But what do you think of this, Dan? Let me know if I'm talking a load of bollocks, and you can you're free to say that I am, because most of the time I do. We pressed well, we hustled well, we tried, we did everything well, but we were getting the set pieces wrong at the back, and we were also not creating clear-cut chances. I know Son had an effort. We had, obviously, we hit the post as well a couple of times in the game. You know, there were moments.
We nearly scored from set pieces ourselves as well, weirdly. Yeah,
it wasn't open play magic, right? There wasn't that kind of creative guile, that inventiveness. But have I got this wrong just from, because I've not rewatched it. But to me, like, sometimes North London derbies are fueled by this extra layer of something, right? When we beat them 3-0 under Conte, there was a layer on top of the actual football. We did everything right as a football team, but there was an electricity to the evening, right? And a lot of that came from us as well, as supporters. And I just felt there was just something in the game that we were doing everything right, but it was just, there wasn't a punch to it. It was like a boxer dancing around and throwing jabs and never quite kind of finding that landing that uppercut or you know that punch to the face.
Yeah.
That would, do you know what I'm saying? There was, did you feel that as well, or do you think that in terms of being competent, we did enough to be in the game? We were just not very good up front and we were terrible at the back.
Yeah, I think there was definitely an element of not having cutting edge, and to an extent, it just not being our day. Like Romero heads one over, he heads one wide, he heads one onto the post. Like he's missed a hat-trick of headers there that were just unlucky, right? Like they're not easy chances to score. Sonny misses by what is his standards, like an absolute sitter.
Like,
he was in the box, right, by the time he got there. Like, yeah. He's just absolutely blasted it. And I mean, we could talk about him in a little bit, because I thought he was absolutely shocking. Like I said to people, I'd have sold him at half-time, let alone subbed him. I was really angry with his performance, because you can be a player that struggles playing with your back to goal and all this sort of stuff, but when you just can't even control a ball and stuff, like, I don't understand how changing a position on the football pitch makes you so much lesser of a player. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just basic things that he is good at doing, like controlling a ball and fucking passing it 5 yards. Like, just, I don't know. There was just so much wrong with him.
Just
with
stick
him
with him
day,
for a minute. Why do you think it is him? Why has he? I mean, because many players have lost form like recently. It's like a.
Well, it's not just him. Like, Maddison was awful as well. He was really bad. Just missing, anonymous, not in it. Not in the right areas that you wanted him to be, too deep. He looks like a player whose legs have gone all of a sudden.
Who's,
I don't know how
who's
bad
Son
this
or,
angle...
or Maddison?
Maddison. I don't know how bad Maddison, this injury was. Like,
yeah, I think Maddison, I think it's fair to say now, I mean, it's been spoken about enough. He's carrying a knock of some kind. I don't.
But he's not
100%
from this injury, clearly, like in terms of his recovery. But if that's the case, and I thought Kulusevski had a really good game against Arsenal. Like,
yeah, he did.
I mean, he was the best. He was the best sort of like forward outfield player we had. I thought Johnson was impactful when he came on, as was Saar, which I suppose we can talk about the subs in a bit as well. But like Romero and Kulusevski were about the only outfielders who were really doing anything that you felt, yeah, they're going to maybe make something happen here. But yeah, like, I just think that the original thing I was saying was that there was an element of like it not being our day as well. I thought the ref had a shocker, for instance. I thought that we just weren't getting anything out of him. I thought that we were on. I can see why. The thing is, my thought at the time of seeing the offside thing was that, well, no, it's offside. But then I know people bring up that West Ham scored a goal against us at home that was allowed and should have been given offside if Mickey's was, but that's an inconsistency issue. I think ultimately they probably gave the right decision against us at the weekend. That's a different topic. That's a different discussion.
What did you think of the Kulusevski trip? Because like,
there was a really good analysis done on it by I can't remember his name. I think his last name's Warnock. It's not Neil. I don't think it's that. I don't know if his name's Neil Warnock, but it's not that Neil Warnock, you know, on Sky Sports. But he done a really good explanation where there's that guy who goes on Sky Sports who's like the ex sort of like head PFA person, or maybe he's in the PFA or something like that. And he was explaining how, well, there's contact, but it's not enough contact. So, yeah, I think it's the right decision. So then, fair play to this guy who then stood in and said, well, you know, as a player, as someone who's played, like that's not a valid excuse, because you're saying he's fallen over because he's clipped his own foot, but he clips his own foot because he gets touched by Trossard. So if I'm walking forward and Trossard doesn't touch me, my foot goes forward in a normal stride and I don't fall over. So then there's no argument about a foul or a penalty. But because he touches me and that's what makes me make contact with myself, that's then a foul. So it should be a penalty.
Do you know the thing about these inconsistencies is that the way that something is translated, it feels ambiguous enough for there to be this area of, oh no, actually it was soft, it was too soft, it wasn't like a complete foot or the hand or whatever. It was like a touch. It was a subtle touch. Now, if a player loses balance and loses his footing because of the physicality of another player in the penalty box, like, what are we going to start doing? Are we going to start having this kind of like AI technology?
He'd have given that as a free kick if that was outside the box. I'm telling you now, he would have given the free kick.
This is my point. So there's this ambiguity and this inconsistency. And if I just put on my tinfoil hat, I think consciously or subconsciously, it does allow referees to be a little bit creative with their decision making. And I'm not saying, I'm definitely not genuinely, we lost the game. We didn't deserve to win the game on Sunday. I'm over it. It's done. It is what it is. It hurts. I can be as bitter as I want. It's not going to help. I've been here before many times. It doesn't matter. there's always going to be another North London derby. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist. However, I don't trust anyone. Human beings are just, you know.
He refused to go to the screen, didn't he? He refused to take an on-field review.
That's exactly. I was building up to that. I had another 10 minutes of a monologue to get there. But
sorry,
that's fine, mate.
I saved us all then, in that case.
Yeah, you did. Well done. But genuinely, that's my point. What I was going to say is, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't believe that referees decide before the game, I'm going to make sure Tottenham don't win this. I don't believe that. But it is quite funny how Arsenal winning allows the whole television narrative to play out the way that everybody wants it to play out. It could go down to the last game of the season. And for a referee to then kind of consolidate that conspiracy by refusing to go to the camera and then being told to go to the camera, to the screen, and to see it, you kind of think, well, why are you making that decision not to do it? Like, the whole point of VAR is to facilitate that potential that you missed something or misinterpreted something. So consciously saying, no, I don't think it was pen, I don't want to look at it. But they're telling you, no, go look at it. For me, unless I'm misunderstanding something, if there's some context that's missing, for me, that feels a little bit scripted in the moment. It's like improvised Larry David style in that moment.
He didn't give the other penalty, Spook. Like, that was the most fucking obvious penalty you ever need to get. He was standing 6 feet from it, like the incident. Yeah. And the whole crowd went mental. What sort of done it for me was that our bench went mental. Like, I saw all the people come off our bench.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, I saw them all come off and I pointed it out to some people and I was like, right, they've seen this. Like, they wouldn't just do that willy-nilly because they didn't do it for the Kulusevski one and they've done it for this one on Davis. And then the fact that he even had to go to a monitor to see that, I mean, I don't know if it's to do with scripting and stuff like that. I think that it goes back to this stuff that Mark Clattenburg done at the Battle of the Bridge where he came out of his statements and saying things like, I didn't want to be the reason that, you know, Spurs lost the game, so I didn't want to send people off and stuff like that. I think it's a refusal to make decisions that, quite simply, they seem to be overthinking in the moment. Well, if I get this, the ramifications of this could be that they've got to stop that. They've got to just give a decision as it comes, because then whatever will be, and then that's the talking points thereafter.
Play it moment to moment. Just play the moment. It's the same thing with the Champions League Arsenal-Bayern when the Arsenal defender picked the ball up and then the referee basically said, oh, it was like a schoolboy error. I'm not going to ruin the game by giving a penalty.
That's bullshit.
He picked up the ball in the penalty area.
You blew the whistle, he passed it to him and then he picked it up. It's like, that's a miscommunication between players, but it's a foul. So
These players, by the way, are millionaires. They're earning hundreds of thousands per week. They should know how to play football, right? Including those particular ones.
Yeah, as silly, silly mistakes, like,
yeah, as silly as it was, and it was outrageously silly. But come on, you know, we've experienced enough in our time. We've seen the ball cross the line. And the goal not given, and we've seen it the other way around as well. And
I've seen Nani handball it in front of the referee, and then the ref just let him go and put it in the net, like against Man United. Like, I've seen everything in that sense against us.
And I'm sure that if you go back and talk to the referees involved in those incidents, they probably admit to making those mistakes. Yeah, and knowing that they were making a mistake when they were doing it. But look, tinfoil hat off. You know, I'm not using these as excuses. It's just frustrating. Obviously, if you want to be a really good team and you want to be contending and competing, you need to be able to rise above all the other bullshit that might be happening around you and actually somehow use that to your advantage. And I think that's what I meant by spirit. That's what I meant about a layer missing from Tottenham's performance. They were doing the basics right in terms of the pressing and the positioning and the movement of the ball. But then obviously where we were failing was defensively, which was spoken about. Now let's talk about the attacking aspect, because, you know, there was a 5 minute spell, if it was that, where the pace of the ball in the second half, I thought, hello, we're going to do something here. We're going to actually, we're going to get behind them. We're going to score. Like, we get the ball to Johnson. This is looking good. The pace looked good. It was quick. It was sharp. And there was no dithering on the ball. And it kind of went back again because I think Arsenal was slightly more experienced. And credit to them, I hate to say this, they were less tethered to their emotions for once. So they showed maturity in not being drawn in. And it was only up until the point Richarlison turned up. And in fact, this is probably the conclusion to this little monologue. When Richie turned up, that's probably what I meant by spirit as well. That little bit of electricity, that little bit of disruption, that break, just get in amongst it. Do you know what I'm saying? Get in amongst it, like Romero can and did, to be fair. But Richie kind of illustrated, like, if everybody had that type of blood and thunder mentality without going fully Stoke, like without like breaking the actual tactical ideas that we're playing towards, then it disrupts how the other team think, and it might pull them back into that emotional battle. And that's where the pressure is going to be less on Spurs in those moments, because Arsenal have so much more to lose than us. And I think that's where we didn't play it. So there's two things. I want to come back to, because I want to say it now in case I forget it. I want to talk about whether Ange should have played the occasion or not. But before we get to that, and what I mean by that, should we have done everything to stop them winning, even if that meant not playing the way we're meant to play under Postecoglou? That's a separate little discussion point, and I want to ask you about that. But what is going on with the attack? Why is our front six dysfunctional? Kulusevski, obviously, has had poor performances recently, got dropped, he's come back, he was great. Johnson, I think, is terrific. He's really growing into that kind of into Premier League life at Tottenham.
Yeah, I agree.
His numbers look good, and he's just, when he's got the ball at his feet or he's running onto the ball, yeah, he sometimes makes the wrong decision, but he's looking a player, right? But everyone else, we get to the edge of the box and it's slowed down, and it's that low block problem, and it's just persisting, and we're not finding a way to unlock those doors.
Yeah. I think for the vast majority of the Arsenal game, it was that we just lacked that presence up front, because Son was a passenger in the whole game until he went. I mean, I say until he went out wide. When he went out wide, he still bottled any one-on-ones and didn't try and take anyone on or get crosses in. He would just stop, face someone up, and then pass it back 5 yards. He's just not at it. Like when he plays like that, he's so frustrating to watch, because he just looks like not even a tenth of the footballer we know he can be.
Yeah.
And I think Johnson, he was so direct when he came on. He was running, going inside, going outside. What was letting him down was his crossing. I didn't think his crossing was great. There was I don't know if you remember, there was a lot of groans at times when he'd done about three of these like floated sort of crosses, chipped crosses in, and Raya just has to come out and catch
him.
That's a waste of an attack.
Like,
if you're going to send one in, it's just got to be like those ones that we know he can do, those fast, low and hard crosses that can just go in off anyone, whether it's our own player or theirs. Like, you know, it just needed kind of something like that to happen. I don't know if Werner not getting injured could have had any impact on the game. I thought it was a bit of a shame for him that he pulled up with a hamstring injury, because I think that he was causing more headache for someone like Ben White than what Son would have for the rest of the game. And yeah, I think that's kind of what done us in, was that Richarlison came on and automatically we looked like much more. All of a sudden, those centre-backs actually have something to think about and worry about, because he is going to be more physical. He is going to, you know, ruffle some feathers and, you know, just get on people's nerves as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that it was just a combination of things that, as I say, like, you know, it just weren't quite clicking. Like, because the reality was, is that the front three, only two of them, you could say, were going to really do anything. Like, I don't think Son was going to do. I know he scored a penalty, but fuck me, I think most of our players would have scored a penalty. Like, I know you have to do it in a pressurised moment, but he's not getting credits for me for scoring from 9 yards. You know,
yeah.
So like, he wasn't at it. So then all of a sudden, it's just down to Kulusevski, Johnson, and Richarlison. I think that the problem in the first half spoke as well was that the midfield was really imbalanced, because I was really surprised he brought Højbjerg in, because he's not started many games this season. He's won one game in 7 that he started. So he doesn't have a good record when he starts games for us this season, which is obviously partly circumstantial. But, you know, that's not great. It's not great, is it? Like reading when you sort of like hear stats like that. And you think you've got a fit Bissouma who you've lost all season in this role, especially for big games, who has had success against Arsenal's midfield at the Emirates. And you've got Saar, who I think is just, if you don't have him in there, you don't have the energy or, that you need in the midfield. Like he's, you don't have the, you lose so much athleticism. So you've got Højbjerg and Bentancur, who neither of them are as athletic as Saar, really kind of like slowing things down. And like they're not as they didn't seem to be able to cope with the physicality either. And it's not their fault, they're doing the best that they can. So I was kind of questioning the selection a little bit, and that they've got to connect defence to attack.
Here's the problem, Dan. I think the issue is we don't know, along with Postecoglou, we don't know who the what the best midfield lineup is for Spurs right now. On paper, you could probably we could probably all agree who our strongest midfield would be, but in terms of delivery of performance and influence and having authority in the middle, I think he's lacking from all of them for different reasons. I think Saar is probably the less. He's the player I would be least likely to criticise because of his youthfulness and the fact that.
But he's also been the best.
Yeah, he will take the ball forward. You know, he will give you that at the very least. And taking the ball forward is a pretty fundamental thing to.
No, but he does, doesn't he? He advances. He gets us up the pitch because of his ball carrying and his off ball running and where he can receive the ball and stuff like that.
Whereas, obviously Bentancur at his very prime, you know, be pre-injury rather, he would do something very similar. He'd be able to switch. Midfield to attack, you know.
Can you tell me what formation we were actually playing? Because I couldn't tell if we were having if Bentancur and Højbjerg were meant to be two like deeper players with Maddison ahead of them, or if it was meant to be three players in midfield. Do you know what I mean? Like in a traditional sense. Like
I would say, I'll probably embarrass myself. I would say that they were those two were holding back to be deeper
because that's what it looked like, didn't it?
Because the thing is, you're coming up against a team that have that as part of their formation, right? You know, if you're going to get competitive with someone like Declan Rice, and you know that you're in a slight,
they do,
you're in
but
a
they
battle
don't. Because they had Partey in there. Rice is allowed to go further forward. That's the whole. That's like, do you know what I mean? If Jorginho or Partey isn't playing, Rice will take that role. But
this is my point, right? Around the issue with the midfield.
But it's like, I can see that as a fan. So why did I didn't then understand the selection on that basis? I can see that. I didn't really see why we felt the need to play those players because I felt that we could have coped with Bissouma and Saar. Even if you wanted to play them as two deeper players, I just think they would have given us more room because they clearly did when they came on.
Yeah.
Maddison's just receiving the ball so deep that I don't know if he's a 10 or a number 8 in terms of where he's meant to be playing positionally.
This is it.
In the formation, if he's a 10, he's not in the right role. He's not in the right position.
There's no identity to the midfield now. Like there's something lacking because
it's gone, really, isn't it? Yeah, it's
weird. We don't know what Bissouma's trying to do when he's playing. We don't know what what the best combination for Saar is. Who should play alongside him? Bentancur has been quietly good, you know, but not anywhere near the influence and you know, because he was captain material. Before getting injured, just
yeah,
in terms
he's
of,
playing pretty safe by his standards.
Yes, yeah, and I think it's still because he's just come back from two massive injuries, and just there is obviously something ticking away in his head, and he's not exactly 100%, and that's not going to help us. It's not going to help him for the moment. It's the same with Maddison. If it's a new injury or if it's something to do with the last injury that he's had. He's holding back. A lot of people have noticed this. I mean, everybody knows that his form has dipped. Some people are probably quick to just say, well, it's Maddison. We were only ever going to get 15 good games from him a season. He's a highlights player. I've heard that being bandied about already.
Obviously, that's not what I would have said. I would have just said that he's not been playing good, like simply. Not because there's any predetermined thing.
No, 100%. But again, you're dealing with extremes when it comes to...
No, I
anything football related, you know, and what I want to do is try and get in the middle of the extremes and try and work out why you know, the onus is on Postecoglou. There's no doubt about it, because if the midfield isn't quite gelling and working, and it was earlier in the season, and the attack is out of ideas all of a sudden, then there are reasons for this. Now, it might just simply be that we have too many players out of form. It could be as simple as that.
Yeah.
Or it could actually be that the players that we do have, you know, it could be a number of things, right? Across the entire season, the momentum that got broken up, the injuries, the suspensions, all the excuses that we kind of talk about every single week. But on this occasion, it could be that Spurs just need something different. They need something different to galvanise, you know, the midfield and the attack. And, you know, you'd be stupid to think that that's not going to happen. And you'd also be a little bit ignorant to suggest that bringing in new players, better players in some positions, isn't going to have a massive impact on the way that we're going to play going forward in terms of what Postecoglou wants from his team. I mean, the whole point is that there's an evolution. You don't, you know, when we had the players in the squad at the start of this season, if you actually thought that was it, that was enough for us to compete, then you're more of a dreamer than me. I mean,
I agree.
Do you know what I'm saying? I'm happy clappy, but I'm a realist. I didn't expect us to be top four this season. Now I'm disappointed that we're not going to get top four. But in the grand scheme of things, again, it's not as important, because we need to be better than what we are to be able to get top four as a gold standard.
Like you says, being in the top four isn't what makes you better. Like, the actual action or journey of getting better just has to happen. And where you kind of like finish, like whether the difference between finishing fourth or fifth isn't going to determine the level you're at. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like,
I'm not going to mention names. I mean, it doesn't matter. They're not going to listen to this. But I know people that have given up on Postecoglou already. They've decided he's not going to fix the set piece issue. It's done. They keep banging on about Arsenal, and it's weird because Arsenal finished eighth for two seasons, and there's a bit of revisionist history, because I'm hearing people say, no, you could tell what Arteta was trying to do. You could tell what he was trying to do. And I'm thinking, mate, I remember they were playing pretty football, but they were getting slumped, and they were looking quite weak, and they were easily bullied a lot. So what are you saying, that that's okay to happen and you can give that manager time and money, a lot of money? But whereas with Spurs, a few set pieces go in, Big Vic is not so big when he's defending, and what, that's it, that's done deal. We're not going to recover from that. You know, it's frustrating that it's happening every week, but I think that's also a consequence of our form dipping massively towards the back end of this season. It just feels that this season was a tricky one, and I think we've done pretty well. It would have been an 8 out of 10, and it might have slipped to 7 out of 10, but only because of the despondency around the North London Derby and recent results, and players being injured and not performing as well, and one or two off the boil, etc., etc. So, like, we will not know until the summer, because the big part of this entire journey is, who do we actually bring in the summer? Do we actually buy every single type of player that we need immediately to be able to step up a level? Because I think with European football, we're going to need to do that.
I think you've got more license to do that all of a sudden, haven't you, though? Like,
yeah,
if you've got all of a sudden a lot more games to play, you've got more license to do that. Like, you couldn't do too many this last summer because they just weren't going to play. Like, Dragosin's only come in and played two or three games since January.
We won't see him in it until next season, like, in terms of...
Carabag at home.
Yeah.
There you go.
Fucking hell. Right, let's talk about Romero before we go to the Patreon-only part of the podcast. Like,
yes.
Romero... like big conversations everywhere, on other pods, in WhatsApp groups, at the game. Like, he, you know, he's a proper captain, isn't he? Like, it's just in terms of leading by example, leading with action, leading by, you know, when he was up front in the North London Derby, when he was that far forward, I was like, fucking yes, that's what I want to see. Like, everybody should aspire to be like Romero out on that pitch. Like as if your life depends on it. Just do everything that you could possibly do. And I will repeat myself from the Fighting Cock, and I will say this. everybody talks about Romero when he's getting red cards and he's fouling and he's committing crimes against humanity, right? And he's a liability. I think we should sell him. Everyone's talking about him being a liability. What's the point if he's going to go missing for five games a season because he gets reds, blah, blah, blah. But when he's consistent and he's quietly consistent and he's brilliantly quietly consistent, everyone just forgets. Like, he's so good and so dependable. You kind of forget about him. You're more interested in Mickey van de Ven running really quickly over 20 yards, right? Which is great because I love that player as well. Can't head the ball, but I love him. So with Romero, the dialogue around him is really interesting, and it's comparable to what's happening at Spurs because people make these really kind of they make these decisions based on what's happening in the moment and just decide that's it. Like these people that have given up on Postecoglou completely, a minority, I should stress, and the same thing happened with Brennan Johnson earlier in the season. 50 million quid waste of money. They've gone quiet now and now they're picking on Timo Werner. do you know what I'm saying? And this is what I mean about I can't take your perception on Spurs. If you're gonna wobble this much, like commit to it, like the players and the manager are committing to it, and like Romero has, commit to it and let's just see what happens. There's no guarantee. Postecoglou might not be the right man for the job. We will not know till a year or two from now. Let's just back him. But anyway, back to Romero. He's got to be captain, right? I mean, I don't know how good his English is. I don't know whether, you know, I know Son is like club captain and legend and the rest of it.
Yeah. But
you look at Romero and his output on the pitch. And it's, you know, Maddison and Son can't really compare to that often, just in terms of what he brings to the field of play.
Yeah, and I think that before I kind of wax lyrical about him, I think that it's important to recognise that we can sometimes, it's really easy to sometimes be slightly fickle about these sort of things because, you know, at the moment, like, you know, I'm slating Son because of like how he's been playing in recent games. And obviously, like, you know, Maddison's not coming up like sort of trumps either right now. But we know what they're capable of, and then they can make us look. You know, they could have one of these games and performances themselves, whether it's this season or next season, where all of a sudden we turn around and say, "Yeah, that's my captain or vice captain or whatever." Do you know what I mean? And like that's Maddison could have like a Beckham-esque performance, like he did against Greece or something, and we sort of go, "Wow, like that's our captain." Like Maddison's capable of something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But right now, yeah, I mean. Obviously, you know, we're not going to strip Son of the captaincy, obviously. But let's say Son was no longer like at Spurs. That's your captain right there. Like, absolutely. I think he just... The only two players really who... I think the only sort of two players who showed that they really understood that this ain't just a game, this is a derby, was Romero and Richarlison at the weekend.
Yeah.
Richarlison comes on and people can say, oh, he's... It's antics, and I think there was an Arsenal fan who called on to TalkSport and said, like, Romero and Richarlison, they're not proper Spurs, so because they don't care, you know, they're just going to, like, play and all. And blah. I thought it was a really bizarre point, because if he actually understood anything about these players, like, they'll see, he'd know about the things that they say about us as a club.
Yeah.
And that it isn't just on Fitch performances. Like, I think Richarlison does feel, like, properly loved by the Spurs faithful, and... Romero as well. Have you seen Romero when he celebrates when he scores a goal? Like he's grabbing the badge and he's biting the badge and all this sort of stuff, like a psychopath, right? Like he just loves it. And I do think he loves where he is. And I think that, you know, ultimately he's going to want us to win things. I think if he's ever a player that you're worried about, you know, losing to a so-called bigger club, like it's him right now in our team, right? Yeah. I think we're possibly vulnerable to that if the likes of Madrid come calling and whatnot. Because he walks into their team, walks into any team. Like, I think the comments Ange made about him shows you, like, that's quite un-Ange-like since he's been with Spurs, like, to put one player on a pedestal and say that you all need to be like him. That's basically what he said. He said, like, you need to look at what he did in that game, and I want to get more of what's in him and get it into the others. That was his words.
Yeah, yeah, so, yeah.
he doesn't. The fact that he even said it shows you, I think, how angry he was at maybe some of the players' performances. To
yeah,
be honest.
For sure.
But even the post Ramiro did after, I actually saw him after the game. Like I was walking past the stadium, and he was driving out in his Lamborghini Euros. And
we're oh, nice. Right
for some. Yeah. But like he got applauded as he was driving past, and I think he put his hand up sort of to say, you know, that he recognized, he think he'd seen people doing it. He quickly put his hand up or whatever.
Yeah.
But I think it shows you that people understood what he did on Sunday. You know, like he really put himself on the line for the club and for the shirt in a way that the other players just didn't. And he doesn't just do it in that game. He does it well. He literally got sent off for us against Chelsea at home, and he puts everything into every game. Like 5 minutes into the Arsenal game at the weekend, like he could have just cleared the ball, but instead he puts it out for a goal kick by absolutely twatting it off of Martinelli or whoever it was, like Trossard, I think it was. Like he just absolutely boots the ball into him, like out for a goal kick, and screams. And you just think he gets it. this guy is just like he knows what it means. So like, and he is mustard. Like he's so good as a footballer. He's so dependable.
Well, look, I want to talk about Chelsea and Liverpool, but I want to go back to what I said earlier, like the whole thing around, you know, Postecoglou not playing the occasion, not playing, you know, like respecting the fact that it's a North London derby, but not.
Yeah.
Some people are saying, oh, we should have done everything. If that was Conte or Mourinho, we would have done everything to stop them. And in the moment, we would have got a draw, and that's all that matters. Nothing else matters. Postecoglou shouldn't be talking about the longevity of the process he's working on. It's just one fucking game, and it's the biggest game of the season. Win that. Doesn't matter how. Doesn't matter if it goes against your football. And then you crack on with what you want to be doing game to game after that. So it's an interesting conversation to have, mainly because there are elements of it that I kind of agree with, but there's also bits that play into other things. Like when you're playing the ball out, just fucking get rid of it sometimes. Don't hold on to it.
It's almost like new football culture versus old football culture in a way, isn't it? Like that's an interesting way of looking at it, because I think
there's stuff that just
doesn't get seen anymore that you grew up expecting when watching football.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think it's because we're inside each other's heads, mate, as well. You know, 20 years ago, we're not having this conversation, right? There's no such thing as podcasting and the rest of it. It's a conversation in a pub that you're unlikely to remember afterwards because you're fucking pissed. But listen, let's crack on with the Patreon part. So thanks for downloading. If you want to listen to the rest of this pod, go to patreon.com/ spooky in purgatory. Sub to that site, and you get to listen to me and Dan bang on about Spurs for a little bit longer.